Morning, everyone, and welcome to the court. We have two cases today, but before we begin, I'd like to welcome Senior Judge Walter Cox back to the bench. For those of you who have not had the pleasure of appearing before him, I'd like to provide just a very brief overview of his professional accomplishments. Judge Cox is a proud native of South Carolina. After graduating from Clemson University and the University of South Carolina Law School, he served in the U.S. Army. In addition to performing routine duties with the military, Judge Cox also served as the liaison officer to the Minister for Justice of the German state of Bavaria and as the liaison officer to the American Embassy in Austria. After a stint in private practice, he was elected as a judge of the 10th Circuit in South Carolina. In 1984, he was nominated by President Reagan and then confirmed by the Senate to this court. He took senior status in 1999. In 2001, he was appointed chairman of a commission that reviewed the military justice system and then chaired another second commission in 2009. The commissions were appropriately known as the Cox Commissions. In each instance, the commissions he chaired made highly important and significant changes to the UCMJ. Judge Cox drove from Florida to be with us for these cases today and tomorrow, and we're delighted to have him, and we very much appreciate the fact that he would come here. So welcome. Our first case this morning is United States versus Guyton. Mr. Cacera, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? And Captain Hunter, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Cacera, please proceed.
Thank you, members of the court. I'm still getting used to the podium over here. If it please the court, my name is Bill Cacera, and along with Captain Hamstra, we represent the appellant in this case, Sergeant First Class Guyton. I would like to also extend my particular thanks to the senior judge. When I put my very first argument in this court, Senior Judge Cox was on the bench. He doesn't remember that. I do. 47 arguments later, and here he is again. It's just a pleasure to see you, sir. I'm glad we got you away from Seabrook Island and the warm weathers of Florida. Members of the court, as this court knows, we are here to argue one issue which really has two parts to it. And the first of those is that the military judge erred when he attributed 59 days of the delay in this case to the government, or to the defense rather, or to himself, for RCM 707 purposes. We will argue that that granting of attribution of delay to the court was an abuse of discretion. We will also argue that the appellant was deprived his right to a speedy trial under the Sixth Amendment and Barker v. Wingo analysis. Starting with RCM 707, as this court knows, the accused must be brought to trial within 120 days after preferral of charges. That includes that period begins with preferral, and we argue ends with arraignment. There are 59 days at issue, more or less, in this case. And I will confess that I was sitting there last night with a calculator trying to count days in this case. I've realized once again why I went to law school and not to accounting or engineering school. But the days at issue in this case are essentially the 43 days between receipt of charges and arraignment prior to the withdrawal of charges, and 16 additional days between the receipt of re-referred charges and arraignment. And this is as it relates to Guyton 2, as we will call it. If either of these periods of delay are found to be non-excludable, RCM 707 has been violated. We argue, appellant argues, that the military judge abused his discretion in granting himself post-receipt delay, without explanation. There is simply no question that the military judge has discretion to exclude delay. That's black letter law. However, the Army Court of Criminal Appeals held that there is a categorical exclusion under Rule 1.1 of the Army Rules for Practice for Courts Martial, and that this creates a default rule excluding time from the receipt of charges by the military judge to arraignment from the speedy trial clock.
Before we get into Army Rule 1.1, could we talk a little bit about what's necessary under RCM 707?
Sure.
Now, let's say for the sake of argument that a military judge says, on the record, in terms of scheduling the arraignment of this accused, I've looked at my calendar, I'm awfully busy, I've looked at the party's calendars, you're awfully busy. I'm trying to set this up on a date where we'll be able to have both the arraignment and the motions hearing. And that's 59 days from now. And then says, and I deem it appropriate to exclude that time from the RCM 707 clock. Has, under that scenario, has the military judge complied with RCM 707?
This may be a distinction without a difference, Judge, but I just want to make sure I understand your question. Does he do that on the record or in 802?
Does that on the record.
Okay. And he says, looking at the party's count, no, I do not believe that that is sufficient. And
but what else would a military judge need to say?
And I think that while we disagree with the government's use of the analogy to the Speedy Trial Rule, I think both the RCM and the Speedy Trial Act point towards the requirement to put on the record with some specificity. I mean, this court has long held in analogous areas of the law that when a military judge fails to put on the record the rationale for their decision, that their discretion is afforded much less deference. So if all the military judge says, I've looked at the calendars and I've determined that this is the first date available, is the equivalent of saying, I've looked at the evidence and I find that the police acted appropriately in this search and seizure motion. That's not explanation on the record that affords this court or affords the military judge great leniency in terms of their abuse of this court's abuse of discretion standard.
Can you cite anything in the rules or our precedent that would require a detailed accounting of days on the part
I'm reading
of
reading as we speak, Judge. Can I?
Certainly.
I knew I had this, but I don't. The only thing that I can cite to, Judge, very quickly is this court's analysis in several cases that says it's reviewed for an abuse of discretion. Well, if it's reviewed for an abuse of discretion, then there has to be something to review for this court to review.
But what about the fact that when we're talking about abuse of discretion, the heart of that is discretion? Is there an area where a military judge should be afforded more discretion than docketing a case in terms of there are all these moving parts for a trial judge in terms of his or her calendar, the party's calendar, trying to engage in judicial economy? When it comes to abuse of discretion, why shouldn't we be really looking at the discretionary aspect of setting a case?
Well, I think that that is part of this court's purview.
So where are you finding the requirement that there needs to be a specific accounting by a military judge putting it on the record that says explicitly I'm matching up my calendar with the party's calendar and trying to figure out for judicial economy purposes when I also can have something that could turn into a very extensive motions hearing? Why should we require that of a military judge?
Because I think that there is no other way for this court or any appellate court to review the decision of the military judge. Otherwise, you're guessing as to, well, gee, does that calendar lined up? You don't need to do that. What this court should be able to do is to say, and you know, we're not saying that the judge has to go through a day-by-day exclusion. We are nowhere near that standard. But we are simply saying that in order for this court to conclude a review of the actions of the military judge, there has to be more on the record that simply says, I'm setting this case for 59 days from now because I can. And because Army Rule 1.1 says, I don't have to tell you why.
Well, there was more in this case than that, wasn't there, Mr. Kassir? Isn't there a fair amount of discussion on the record about docketing the case and getting it ready for a trial?
There really isn't, Judge. What he says in his explanation on the motion is there's a lot of things that can come into play in docketing a case, and that's why I don't, you know, I mean, he doesn't really
say. Well, I'm talking about earlier when they're actually docketing the case.
Okay.
And they're going through the discussion on the record. Isn't there a fair amount of discussion there about why he's doing what he's doing?
And that's why there are certainly times that the defense says, you know, in our brief, why the appellant says, we agree that this period of time was excluded. But just as it would not be enough for a military judge in a suppression motion to say, well, there was a lot of evidence covered on it, and based on those reasons, I don't have to put my findings of fact on the record, there has to be something on the record for this court to review.
So let me make sure I understand. Your complaint is your complaint simply that he didn't put what might very well be a discussion in the record of why these days are being excluded? He didn't put that in the form of a of a finding? Is that your complaint? Are you complaining that even if he had done that, that still wouldn't have been enough?
Our complaint is that Army Rule 1.1, which grants the military judge the carte blanche authority and creates a de facto rule that receipt of charges stops the speedy trial clock, violates RCM 707, which says that arraignment stops the speedy trial clock. That is our complaint number one. Complaint number two is that if the military judge is going to find an exclusion of time, he has to do more than say, well, Rule 1.1 says I can do this.
Counsel, can I ask two questions? First, I think as you discovered, the cases under 707C from our court are few, and there's not much that gives us too much guidance. In the Lazauskas case, the question was about the five-day mandatory waiting period. But in that case, there was another portion right before that where they were counting the excludable delays, and the court just simply said the parties agreed that arraignment should be on November 15th, and the judge went along with that. And that was the end of it. If there's no objection or the parties agree on a particular arraignment date, does the judge still have to give reasons? Because it didn't seem like that was the case in Lazauskas. I mean, I don't have the record of Lazauskas, but just looking at what the court said, it sounded like, well, they agreed on November 15th for the arraignment, so all the period from the receipt of charges to that period are excluded.
I don't recall that quote in the case, Judge. I'm certainly happy to take a look.
Well, it wasn't really the issue in the case.
Yeah. But I also don't recall that I don't believe that was the issue in this case. I believe the military judge set an arraignment date. But as you've seen by the tremendous amounts of litigation in the meantime, it wasn't a question of the government or the defense just saying, okay, fine.
Well, I mean, the point there was that he didn't seem to give a lot of reasons other than that's the date. Let me ask this question, too. Does it matter in terms of waiver or forfeiture that, you know, there was no contemporaneous complaint about the arraignment date by the trial defense counsel? Does that put us into plain error territory?
No, Judge. Just as, you know, and I was contemplating this exact question last night and analogizing it to whether the government has a requirement to say, Judge, we're not happy with an arraignment date 40 days out, for example. We want to arraign the accused now to put the defense on notice of either saying, no, we need a delay, and, you know, and therefore waiving the issue, or no, we're fine with that date. Neither one of those is what happened in this case. So I think that what you have in this case, Your Honor, is the military judge simply says, we're going to set an arraignment date. There's no reason. The defense doesn't, we're not on the record. The defense doesn't get to say, you know, no, nor did the government say, no, we need to arraign him earlier.
Well, would that be an appropriate topic for a motion for appropriate relief? That if they set the arraignment date 6 months from now, couldn't the parties say, no, we don't want that?
I think they could have, absolutely.
But if they don't do it, is that a forfeiture?
I don't believe there's any forfeiture in this case, as the defense maintained while they withdrew their motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, they maintained their motion to dismiss for lack of a speedy trial. So clearly they didn't waive the issue. And they didn't forfeit the issue.
Well, it seems like there's two questions. One is on the speedy trial. Have you subtracted the right dates? But it seems like there's a separate question about whether you've objected to the military judge's approval of the arraignment date at the particular time. I mean, somebody could have said, "Well, what's your reason for setting it at December and October, whatever the dates? I forget the exact dates." But that never happened.
And again, I go back to the fact that it's also incumbent upon the government. You know, as we point out in our brief, Judge, there's three parties to any trial. Only two of them have control over when or over ensuring that the accused goes to trial in a speedy manner. And the government didn't say, no, you're not going to arraign him. We don't, you know, there's three judges at Fort Hood or Fort Bragg. You know, can you get one other judge? Can you get a reservist? Can you do something to arraign this guy earlier? And then if the defense says, no, we're fine with an arraignment in 40 days or whatever, then perhaps we have a question of forfeiture, but that's not what happened in this case. So, Your Honor, I'd like to pursue that, though,
in terms of Judge Maggs' point, in terms of curing this problem, if you don't have defense counsel saying, wait a minute, I've got a problem with this 59 days to the filing of a motion. Why isn't it appropriate for the military judge to assume that everyone is fine with 59 days?
Well, because the defense did say that they had a problem with the 59 days.
And when did they say that?
Well, there was an ongoing motion for speedy trial violation, and when the judge set, and when the judge finally said, the reason why I'm excluding this time, you know, it's not like the judge said, there's 59 days out there so that you all don't need to worry about. I mean, he announced on the record during the final session as to the motion to dismiss for speedy trial that he was excluding those 59 days, which is really the first time the defense gets to say, well, no, that doesn't make any sense. The Army can't violate RCM 1707.
But that was after the 59 days that elapsed.
That's correct, which is why it's incumbent upon the military judge and the government, the two people in charge of the docket, to say this case has to move forward than, quicker than that, and that didn't happen in this case. And I think that's the crucial difference, is whether or not we're going to put the onus upon the accused, the accused who has no role in moving a trial forward, no realistic role, he doesn't run the docket or assign trial counsel, or
counsel,
the government.
In this particular case, as I recall the facts, and I stand to be correct, but there were two motions for delay made by the defense counsel. Were there not?
There were, yes, sir.
Didn't that end the case?
No.
As far as speedy trial?
No, because if you add those times, if you...
No, I don't want to add them. I just want to say there's no interest in a speedy trial here, Your Honor. We request a delay.
No.
End of Barker v. Wingo, end of Rule 120.
The reason why it doesn't, Judge, is you have to take into consideration when those requests for an extension took for a delay took place. One was at the original period, indictment one. The other one was their experts all showed up for trial. They're ready to rock and roll, so to speak. And the eve of trial in Guyton 2, the government says, we need to withdraw because there's all these problems with the convening order that we created. The judge then says, fine, the next available date is X date. And the defense says, our experts aren't available on X date. So we've either got to go to trial without a defense, or because of this mess you created, you've got to push it back a little bit. So therefore, there's not a de facto, you just count those days off. Your Honors, I've not gotten a chance to talk about the Barker v. Wingo analysis. Chief Judge, with the Court's permission, I'd like to get into that a little bit on my rebuttal as my time is out.
Yes, before you conclude, though, before the government engages in its argument, I'd like you to please address one issue. Is Army Rule 1.1, the validity of that rule, before this Court?
Yes.
Based on the issue granted. Can you please explain why?
Absolutely. If the Army promulgates a rule that preempts the authority of the President to promulgate Rule for Court Martial 707, that rule is inapplicable. And that will, this court, the validity of that rule is before the court, without question.
So I thought your issue with Rule 1.1 was that because there's no because the military judge doesn't have to give an explanation, there's no evidence in the record on which an accused can later challenge whether or not there's an abuse of discretion. Now, that makes the rule somewhat difficult to administer, but you've also suggested that there is an inconsistency between Rule 707 and Army Rule 1.1. Is there a logical or a legal or a textual inconsistency between those rules that you can explain for us? Or is it just the fact that Rule 1.1 makes it impossible for the accused to ever demonstrate there is an abuse of discretion?
No, the rule is facially invalid because it excludes from the speedy trial clock time that Congress has, and the President rather, has said is attributable to the government, which is the time from received by a military judge to arraignment. The military judge said the de facto impact of Army Rule 1.1 was that the speedy trial clock stopped at receipt of charges from the military judge. That's clearly inconsistent with RCM 707, which says that the speedy trial clock stops upon arraignment. So therefore, Rule 1.1 is facially, the defense would argue, is facially invalid and certainly invalid as it applies to this case. Further questions, judges?
No, we're all set. Captain Hunter, are you prepared to go forward?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do.
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Cox, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Cynthia Hunter, and along with my co-counsel, Major Mark Robinson, we represent the United States. This court should affirm the judgment of the Army Court regarding the speedy trial issue because appellant was not denied his right to speedy trial under RCM 707C, nor under the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution. Appellant's procedural right to speedy trial was not violated because his final arraignment occurred on day 71, as the military judge found in his ruling at JA 513, well within the 120-day time frame prescribed by RCM 707A. And the military judge appropriately excluded judicial delay pursuant to Rule of Court 1.1. Appellant's constitutional right to speedy trial was not violated because after balancing the Barker factors, they weigh against him, especially the fact that appellant was not at all prejudiced by the delay.
Turning also, first, can you address what seems to be a very important point, which is the validity of Rule 1.1? As I understand Mr. Casera's argument, RCM 707 C says that the, or 707 says that the clock starts upon receipt of the charges. But effectively, Army Rule 1.1 says it doesn't start until arraignment because all of the time between receipt and arraignment is automatically judicially approved and excluded. How can Rule 1.1 be consistent with RCM 707 if it says that, in effect, the clock starts at arraignment, not at receipt?
Yes, Your Honor. And so the government's position is that Rule 1.1 is consistent with RCM 707C and its discussion for multiple reasons. Now, in U.S. v. Torres, the Army Court stated there's no per se requirement that the military judge must grant delay in writing. Now, also, the discussion portion to the RCM is non-binding. In pertinent part, the discussion states, when practicable, the reasons and dates supporting the delay should be reduced to writing. Now, that word choice of when practicable and should, those are permissive words. And it allows them, it provides the military judge latitude to predetermine excludable delay periods, exactly as Rule 1.1 advises. Now, not all delay periods are going to be excludable under Rule 1.1, and specifically in U.S. v. Hawkins, the court stated that that if there were unusual circumstances, then Rule 1.1 would not apply. And so that's something the military judge still is required under the rules to make an independent determination as to the good cause that exists for the periods of delay, and also to ensure the reasonableness of the length of the delay, which in this case the military judge did do. There was good cause for both periods of delay, and I'll discuss each of those periods in turn.
Well, before you go on to that, I think it's consistent with what Judge Maggs is talking about here, trying to find out how Army Rule 1.1 can live in harmony with the RCM 707. RCM 707 provides a list of when there is pre-approved delay. Why should that not be viewed by this court as an exhaustive list?
Your Honor, so in terms of RCM 707, so a portion of it provides a list, but in fact, in terms of delay excluded by the military judge, the last portion does not include an exhaustive list, and the rule, as I'm sure the court is aware, was amended to remove the non-exhaustive list, and the language of RCM 707.
Amended to remove what?
The exhaustive list of reasons for delay, Your Honor. And so RCM 707C, it now states that all periods of delay that have been approved by the military judge shall be excluded. In addition to...
But isn't the operable term there, all periods of delay approved by the military judge are excludable? How does that mesh with Army Rule 1.1 that says it's an automatic exclusion?
Yes, Your Honor. The military judge is still not excused from making that determination of the fact that there is good cause underlying.
Where did, in this case, did the military judge use the words good cause?
So, Your Honor, In the military judge's ruling, he did not specifically state good cause. However, he did lay out his reasoning, and the reasons that he gave for excluding the delay here do amount to good cause.
Now, what specifically are you referring to? Are you referring to the passage where the military judge is talking about there are not so uncommon instances, and then there's nothing here that was out of the ordinary?
Yes, Your Honor.
That passage right there, in your view, passes muster in terms of indicating that the military judge found good cause to exclude this time from the RCM 707-120-day clock?
Yes, Your Honor. That, in conjunction with the good cause that is evident from the record of trial itself, is sufficient to show that there was good cause for the military judge excluding these periods of delay.
Now, I think that's consistent with the point that Judge Sparks was making earlier. Can you point to places in the record where you feel that there was sufficient information and evidence that would show why the military judge accounted these days as excludable?
Yes, Your Honor. So turning to the first period of delay, the 43 days, and that's the period between 22 August and 4 October. So that was, we've just gone over the military judge's discussion and his ruling about that. But for this first period, it's significant, as the court brought up earlier in questioning the appellant, that the appellant was on notice of the military judge's intent to combine the arraignment and motions from the judge's pretrial order that was sent out on 25 August of 2017. And since there were no unusual circumstances here, and the judge was correctly operating under the default rule of Rule 1.1, the fact that the appellant failed to oppose that delay or request an accounting for that delay, that is significant in the government's view. Now, the good cause for the second period, the 16 days of delay, is that it coincided with the Thanksgiving Day holiday and those four non-duty days, and that's at JA 250 and also 425 through 428. And then also it appears from the email traffic at JA 425 and 420 through 28 that the earliest date for arraignment would have been 6 December of 2018. And most importantly, for this second period, the appellant actually requested that the arraignment be delayed and held on 8 December of 2017. And that's in the ruling at JA 510. And now in terms of the reasonableness.
So can I ask you a question then? From the government's position, would Army Rule 1.1 have to survive appeal here in order for the government to prevail in this case through the prism of RCM 707?
Would you mind repeating that question, Your Honor?
Sure.
Thank you.
So let's say, for the sake of argument, that this court were to conclude that Army Rule 1.1 can't survive because it's inconsistent with the provisions of RCM 707. Can the government, based on the record before us, still prevail if we impose an RCM 707 analysis here?
Yes, Your Honor, we can. Our position is that the government can, based on this good cause that I've just cited to from the record itself. Now, in terms of this...
Captain Hunter, before you go on, can I ask a question about the wording of Rule 1.1 and your position on it, or the government's position on it? The rule says any periods of delay, blah, 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 are considered pretrial delay approved by the judge. And here are the words I want you to focus on. Unless the judge specifies to the contrary. Now, does that mean that the judge could conclude that he is excluding a certain amount of time, normally that would be attributable to him, but this also deciding that some of that time attributable to him is not going to be excluded because of whatever reasons? How would that situation arise? I mean, it's like the judge has to tell on himself? Or how does that work?
Your Honor, I would say that if there were a situation where the judge were concerned that on review it may not be apparent from the record itself what caused the delay, that would be a situation giving rise to when the reasoning should still be put on the record.
So basically he would say, normally this period of time that I have the case, normally it would be excludable under 1.1, but I'm not going to exclude it because I had the case too long? Or I'm trying to understand what that means, and does it in fact, is it significant, that wording, because is that what saves the 1.1 from being completely inconsistent with 707?
Your Honor, so that portion of the rule certainly contemplates that there will be cases in which the rule will not apply, and that military judges, you know, they need to use their best discretion in applying that rule and in allowing the pre-approved delay to operate.
No, I understand that, but I'm trying to understand under what situation would the judge conclude that he's the one to blame, or she is the one to blame for the delay.
Captain Hunter, could that arise in a situation where, let's say for the sake of argument, we're talking about Fort Hood, and the military judge is saying, I'm looking at my calendar, but I am so jam-packed with cases from dusk to dawn, 5 days a week, that I'm unable to schedule this arraignment earlier, and it's because TJAG is not ensuring that we military judges have enough resources here. In other words, we need two more military judges here, and therefore, this is really the fault of the government. It's time that I'm taking, but it's the fault of the government. Would that scenario fit?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that scenario would fit. I think that's a very good example of that.
And in fact, is that what saves it from being completely inconsistent with 707? Otherwise, the defense claim is that, hey, look, this rule is inconsistent and in contravention of 707 because it allows the judge, and I'm putting words in the counsel's mouth, he can correct me on rebuttal, but my understanding is that he's claiming the rule is inconsistent with 707 because it is basically an open invitation to the judge to just account for all the days that the case has been in his possession for no reason whatsoever.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that example, among many others that I'm sure we could come up with, is part of what helps with the validity of Rule 1.1.
I see.
Absolutely.
Counsel, years ago I wrote a dissent in a case in which I said, on day one, everyone knows when day 120 is. That's no longer the case, because now you've got Rule 101 saying, well, we've got day one, but we don't know when day 120 is because we don't know what the judge is going to do. But every case involves a judge. That should have been contemplated when they adopted Rule 707, that there would be some time involved with the judge. So I don't understand Rule 101, why they did it, unless it's a subterfuge to get around the rule.
Your Honor, so Rule 1.1 provides predictability for the parties, and it in fact it promotes the drafter's intent behind RCM 707C because it avoids.
Can I just stop you there? I think that conflicts with the point that Senior Judge Cox is making. Predictability is out the window. When you know when day one is, you know when day 120 is. Under Army Rule 1.1, you don't really know when this arraignment is going to take place. I think that's Senior Judge Cox's point. And yet you're saying that Army Rule 1.1 provides predictability. How is that so?
Your Honor, I say that because counsel and the military judges, they are bound under Rule 1.1, of course, as well as RCM 707C. And so because there's this understanding that if there is delay following the referral of charges and between arraignment, that it's going to be, you know, operating under the default rule absent some sort of explanation, then that is what provides the predictability here. And so that is why in this case, Your Honor, the government believes it's a significant point that the appellant was on notice of the judge's intent to combine the motions and arraignment hearing, and this is for the first period of delay, and failed to make any sort of objection to that.
If Army Rule 1.1 is such a wonderful innovation, why doesn't the Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps have it?
Your Honor, I can't speak to what...
Fair enough.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but Could you answer the question, the hypothetical that Chief Judge Olson asked Mr. Cacera at the start of the oral argument, that the military judge says, well, I've looked at government's calendar, I've looked at defense's calendar, I've looked at my calendar, and arraignment will be on this particular date, and gives no further explanation. Mr. Cacera said, well, that's an abuse of discretion because you can't review it because there's no reason. I think practical experience shows this happens all the time. So I would assume your answer would be, no, that's not an abuse of discretion. If you look at both parties, if the judge says, I looked at your calendar, I looked at my calendar, and December 10th is the day to go, that's the day we'll go, and nobody objects, that no further reason is necessary. Is that your understanding, that no further reason is necessary? And if so, why no further explanation is necessary by the military judge? And if so, why is no further explanation necessary?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that does accurately summarize the government's position on this. And no further explanation is necessary under those circumstances because there were no unusual circumstances that would have changed the default rule of 1.1. And in addition, Rule 1.1 does not excuse the military judge from the requirements of RCM 707, which require an inquiry, an independent determination as to the good cause underlying the periods of delay and the reasonableness in length of those delays. And it's for those reasons that we've discussed that the military judge here did not abuse his discretion in excluding the 59 days of delay. And at this point, I'd like to turn to the Sixth Amendment speedy trial claim that the appellant also makes. Now, the government's position is that this claim fails. And just to start with the point of prejudice, so appellant has not even come close here to demonstrating the type of prejudice that the speedy trial right was designed to protect. And this factor weighs heavily in the government's favor. Because the appellant's alleged prejudice only speaks to really the collateral results of being administratively flagged, the government's position is that U.S. v. Dooley is not applicable here. And in looking at the interest more closely, the appellant experienced absolutely no pretrial restraint. He was able to move about as he wished during the pendency of his trial. His anxiety toward trial was normal. And there's no evidence in the record of trial that the delay impeded his ability to put on a defense. And thus, this prong weighs strongly in the government's favor. Now, shifting to the reasons for delay, there are two main reasons that both government and appellant focus on here. First, the defense requested delay, totaling 111 days, and the government's misguided management of the CMCO. Now, admittedly, the government does bear responsibility for the CMCO confusion by withdrawing and re-referring under a new CMCO within 8 days, and this demonstrated their ability to react within a period of 8 days so quickly. This demonstrates a reasonable diligence toward trial. And this reason should be weighted less heavily against the government than a deliberate attempt to delay trial, such as in Barker v. Wingo. Overall, in light of the severity of appellant's offenses and the context surrounding the delay, this factor favors the government. And then finally, looking at the timing of appellant's speedy trial claim, speedy trial was demanded only when it became clear that the government could not proceed based on the CMCO issue. And it was followed by, as this court has also noted, the appellant's subsequent requests for a lengthy delay. And this belies the genuineness of his speedy trial demand. Now, thus, the Barker factors favor the government, and the appellant's Sixth Amendment speedy trial right was not violated. In conclusion, this court should affirm the judgment of the Army Court regarding the speedy trial issue. Thank you.
Mr. Cacera.
Think about trifocals, I can still see. I want to start with a question from Judge Olson and a question from the senior judge. Raised to the government. And Judge Olson, one of the questions, Judge, you raised to me was, where does it say in Rule 707 as to what the military judge's responsibility is? And I looked back at the discussion, and there's two places. One is in rules, and you know the way they paginate and, you know, outlining of the, I think it's 3C, where it says that the judge has to consider the facts and circumstances of the case. And at one point, the court said, the rule says that there are three periods of automatic exclusion. When the accused is AWOL, when there's a stay in the proceedings because of a government appeal, or when the accused is incompetent to stand trial. Those are automatically excluded. The government screwing up the docket and the military judge receiving the record of trial, or receiving, rather, the docket request or in the charges, is not one of those that's just an automatic pass. RCM 707 says you've got an automatic pass in these three areas, but otherwise, you've got to put the facts and circumstances on the record. The facts and circumstances are not, well, judges are busy people. Counsel are busy people. Therefore, we're going to set the arraignment for a later date. You know, Judge Cox, senior judge, you addressed your dissent when you said that everybody knows what day 120 is. Nobody knows what day the convening authority is going to refer charges. So if the convening authority refers the charges on day 119, and the military judge says, okay, we're going to arraign him in 6 months because 1.1 says that I don't have to worry about that, that's clearly violative of RCM 707. Secondly, Judge Cox, you once famously said that the government gets, I know the analogy is going to come back to me in just a second. I promise you it'll make sense, senior judge. When you said that the government gets an innumerable number of peremptory challenges because they pick the panel. The government picks when cases get referred. The government picks when charges are preferred. The government knows when they're going to send charges to the military judge. They are the ones responsible for the clock. And for the Rule 1.1 to simply say, well, we're just going to exclude this period of time because we can, or because we think it's the right thing to do, is clearly violative. So, Judge Hardy, I wanted to make sure that I cleared up any questions that you might still have. It is clearly violative of RCM 707 for the Army to simply say, we're taking that authority away from the military judge, and we're vesting it in whoever writes this regulation. We're taking away the requirement under RCM 707 that the clock stops at arraignment, and we're substituting our authority and our judgment that says the clock stops upon receipt of charges, which would lead to and could lead to the absurd result of a military judge getting charges in one day and saying, you know, we're like, Judge Olson, this is the Chief Judge, this is in line with your hypothetical, and just saying, look, we're really busy here. But this isn't Fort Meade, and I think that it's important for the court to take notice of that. I forget which the court's name and what the case was in which this court says that one of the things that this court considers is the availability of military judges. This is Fort Hood. This court can practically take judicial notice of the fact that it's a really busy jurisdiction by the fact that you all get a lot of cases from Fort Hood. I think my last three arguments in this court have been from Fort Hood cases. There's a number of military judges. There's a number of reservists. There's a number of options open up to the government. You know, senior judge, you said, you know, or I think it was the chief judge, you said, well, you know, the next 5 days are really booked. Okay, arraign on Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. Defense, you don't want to do that? Put in a request for a delay. This is not complicated stuff. And for the Army to simply, by fiat, take that power or take that authority away from the president renders the rule inoperable. I've only got 40 seconds, so I would like to just talk very briefly about the Barker v. Wingo analysis. The government asks you to basically overrule United States v. Dooley and to say, what you really need to do is to just sort of analogize this to a civilian case. He wasn't in confinement, so therefore there can be no Barker v. Wingo analysis. That's not what Dooley says. And if you, again, take the government's argument to an illogical extreme, the government could refer charges or prefer charges against an E-4, and he could stay in that status for 10 years as an E-4, performing E-4 duties, but never getting promoted, never getting to deploy, never getting to do the things that one would do if they were allowed to advance in their rank, and it's all good because he's not in pretrial confinement. That's not what Dooley stands
for. How do you deal with the fact that after the 59-day delay that you argue prejudiced the appellant? That the defense then requested its own longer delay.
Well, again,
if he was suffering for those 59 days, wasn't why then turn around and request a delay?
Well, as I addressed to the senior judge earlier, at that point, the witnesses were not available. So you either go to a naked trial and say, well, we can't do anything because all our experts are elsewhere, or you get to trial as soon as you humanly can, which is what they did in this case. Chief Judge, subject to any further questions from the members of the court, that concludes the appellant's presentation. We ask that you reverse the charges and dismiss with prejudice. Thank you.
Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides. The court will reconvene at 10:45.